What I'd like to talk to you about this afternoon is some of the theoretical work and some of the experimental work that my lab's been doing on conflict between the sexes. And the type of conflict that we evaluate is genetic conflict that occurs over evolutionary time. And I'm going to tell you about two fundamentally different types of intersexual conflict, that is, conflict between the sexes. One occurs at the level of interactions between males and females, different individuals in the context of reproduction. This will be some of my older work, and I'll spend about the first third of the seminar on this topic. Then I'll switch to our newer work on intra-individual conflict. This conflict occurs when the same genes are expressed in the two different sexes, which represent different environments that they're expressed in, and they can be selected differently in this male versus female environment. The first thing I want to do is make it clear what I am and what I'm not going to talk about. So I'm going to do sort of a phylogeny on evolutionary conflict. And we can first decompose it into the interspecific level between different species versus the intraspecific level within a single species. And at the interspecific level, we have a phenomenon called the Red Queen process. It's called the Red Queen because in this fairy tale, there was a context where Alice was running as fast as she could just to stay in place because the queen's army was after her, and if she slowed down a little bit, they'd catch up. And here's how this race, perpetual race, takes place. We have a species, for example, an herbivore, and its enemies, its pathogens, its parasites, its predators, its competitors, and we can develop an endless cycle, an antagonistic cycle between them. So the predator adapts, the prey counter-adapts, the predator counter-counter-adapts. This can lead to an endless cycle of adaptation and counter-adaptation, driven by conflict between a species and its enemies, and it can drive genetic change within a lineage. But this isn't the kind of conflict I'll focus on today. Instead, I'll focus at the intraspecific, or the within a species level. And at the intraspecific level, we can have intragenomic conflict versus intergenomic conflict. Intragenomic conflict is conflict between different genetic elements that reside in the same individual, such as a gene in the nucleus compared to a gene in the cytoplasm. And this conflict can clearly occur between the sexes. As an example of this, I want you to consider the transmission dynamics of a nuclear gene compared to a cytoplasmic gene. Nuclear genes, every generation, go to both sexes, and next generation, they're transmitted again through both sexes. But a cytoplasmic gene is only transmitted through the matriline. So this female gives the gene to her sons and her daughters, but it's a dead end in the sons, and it's only transmitted again through the daughters and through her daughters and so on. So anything that one of these genes can do to maximize the survival and growth of daughters at the expense of sons will be favored. And these cytoplasmic genes have evolved a number of ways to do this. They feminize, they sterilize, or they downright kill sons to promote the success of the daughters. And this is clearly intersexual conflict, but it's not the kind of conflict I'll talk about today. I will talk about this third type, which is intergenomic conflict. This is conflict between different genetic elements that reside in different individuals and mediate contests, for example, competition between them. This conflict can occur between genes that occur at the same gene locus or same position on a chromosome, but more importantly, it can occur between allelomorphs or different gene forms that occur at different gene loci. The idea is that this interlocus or between gene conflict can lead to an endless cycle, which is just like the Red Queen, but now the players aren't species within a community, but instead they're genes within the genome of a single species. As an example of this conflict, I want you to consider the conflict that can potentially occur between the sexes. If we have true genetic monogamy, and by true genetic monogamy I mean one male mates with one female over his and her entire lifetime, then there's absolutely no opportunity for conflict because there's a perfect correlation between the fitness of a male and his mate and a female and her mate. If we have any deviation, though, from this lifelong monogamy, then there's an imperfect correlation in fitness between males and females, and this opens up manifest opportunities for genetic conflict. As an example of this conflict, I want you to consider the seminal fluid proteins of the species that I study, Drosophila melanogaster, the common fruit fly that you have when you're in the grocery store and you're near the fruit, or you're eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. They like both opportunities. You know that when a male mates with a female, he provides her with sperm. But it turns out in these flies, and almost all other organisms, that sperm is packaged in a matrix of about 100 different seminal fluid proteins. Many of these proteins make their way into the bloodstream of the female, and they affect her endocrine system. That is, they act as pheromones. And they clearly do things that are good for the male. They influence the female's brain, and they shut down her sexual appetite, so she's less likely to mate with a competitor male. They influence her ovary, and they increase the rate of ovulation, so she makes more offspring for this male now before she ultimately remates with another male and starts producing offspring later for that male. And these proteins play a critical role in mediating sperm competition. These flies typically mate with many different males, and sperm are stored, so sperm for different males are present in the reproductive tract of the female simultaneously, and they clearly compete, and that competitive process is determined in large part by seminal fluid proteins. Everything we know about seminal fluid proteins are good for the male, but we know that these same proteins are mildly toxic to females. The more they receive, the more rapidly they die. There's no suggestion here that males are trying to hurt the females that produce their offspring. The idea is that there's an imperfect correlation between the fitness of a male and his mate, and the harm to females is an incidental byproduct of the good things that the seminal fluid proteins are doing for the male. So to the extent that we have one set of genes that code for seminal fluid proteins and another set of genes that code for their receptors within females, we have an opportunity for a red queen process, a cycle of antagonistic coevolution of adaptation and counteradaptation between different genes in the genome of a single species. So we wanted to provide experimental evidence that this process might occur. And there's an immediate problem. And this problem hides virtually all the evidence for antagonistic coevolution between the sexes. And it's this cycle of adaptation and counteradaptation. And I'm going to use a metaphor to illustrate how this works. I want you to consider the sexes as a pair that's dancing in an antagonistic dance. Females generally invest more in reproduction compared to males. So the less investing sex usually steps first to take advantage of this. The investing sex countersteps. And in this step-counterstep, representing adaptation and counteradaptation in the metaphor, the couple moves across the dance floor. And this movement across the dance floor represents their history of antagonistic coevolution. But because they're locked in this cycle of step-counterstep, adaptation-counteradaptation, they move very little relative to one another. So at any single point in time, you expect the two sexes to be remarkably well-adapted to one another, and there's little evidence for this history of antagonistic coevolution. In our first set of experiments, we used genetic tools to stop one sex, in this case females, from evolving, but permitted the other sex to continue to evolve. The logic here is if they're really locked in this antagonistic dance, the untethered partner should come crashing in to the tethered partner, and that would be our evidence for antagonistic coevolution. So these are older experiments, and I'm only going to briefly describe them here. We had two experimental populations where males could adapt to females, but females couldn't adapt back. And we had two control populations where both males and females were free to co-evolve. So the data I'm going to show you is always the experimentals relative to the controls. So the experimental values minus the controls. And we, after 32 generations of the situation where males could adapt to females in the experimental populations, but females couldn't adapt back, we measured the fitness of the males. That's their biological performance, or how well they pump their genes across one full generation. We found about a 25% increase in the net fitness of these males, which in evolutionary terms is a very rapid increase in fitness. We broke this down into a number of fitness components, and one of them is offense. This is the phenotype of a male when he encounters a male that just mated with another male. She has an ample supply of sperm, and she doesn't need more. But the male is selected to try and persuade the female to mate with him, and if he does, he's selected to displace the resident sperm and replace it with his own. And we found a substantial increase in the the offense ability of the experimental males when challenged with the females they had specifically adapted to compared to the controls. We also looked at the defense phenotype, and this is mediated exclusively via the seminal fluid proteins in Drosophila. Through these proteins, which act as pheromones, he has to try and persuade her by affecting her endocrine system not to remate with another male, and if he does, to make sure his sperm isn't displaced by the second male. And we found a marked increase in the defense ability of the experimental males as well. Everything we measured about the experimental males improved when they could adapt, but their mates could not. Pardon me? We use cytogenetic constructs, so the female genes every generation are brought in anew from a base population. The male population stay in the male genes stay in the population, so the female genes are naive every generation to the adaptation by the males. And that's done by taking advantage of the fact that male Drosophila don't recombine, and we use translocations and compound X chromosomes to make one genomic haplotype or full set of genes remain in males and never go to females, or if they do, they're lost from the population the next generation. So we had evidence that the males adapted to this stationary target, but was this harmful to the females? Did it represent something that would initiate antagonistic coevolution? To answer this, we had to look at the fitness of the mates of these males. So when we looked at the fecundity of females that were continuously housed with the males that could adapt to them, but they couldn't adapt back, we found no change in their fecundity, but we found that the survival went down markedly. And it went down in large part because these males had evolved to be more amorous to these females. And because of this, they mated with them more often. And because of the generalized toxicity of seminal fluid proteins, the females died more rapidly. Yeah. There's almost no traits on the Y chromosome. There are some. The Y chromosome influences fitness. All the traits I'm telling you about here are independent of the Y chromosome. They're on the part of the genome that is expressed in both males and females. There is an effect to the Y, and it's substantial in effect, small in gene number, but it's not part of the scenario I'm showing you here. It's another thing that we've studied in my lab, but I won't be talking about here. So lastly, we looked at the survival of females when they mated a single time to the experimental versus the control males, and we found that in one replicate, but not the other, the females died more rapidly, indicating that the seminal fluid became more toxic to these females. So we have pretty good evidence here that the evolutionary advance by the males, when they could evolve but their mates could not, was at the expense of their mates.
There's some explanation. I mean, there's obviously no evolutionary advantage to a seminal fluid that's toxic to the female.
Well, there is.
So you kill off the female before she can...
Oh, no. These toxic effects are very small. Males aren't killing females immediately. It takes a long time for them to die. They just die more rapidly. So they're harmed by the seminal fluid proteins, but not in a way that they die immediately.
So is there some selective advantage
in that? The harm to females is a byproduct of the good things that are being done. For example, the female is trying to maximize her lifetime fecundity, but the male wants to maximize her short-term fecundity. So he selected to make her pump out babies now, even if it means she'll produce fewer later on.
The overall fitness of the species has gone up.
No. In other experiments, we showed that this conflict actually reduces the fitness of the species. It does not help. In general, things don't evolve for the good of the species, but the good of the individual, frequently at the expense of the species. And this is a good example of that case. We did experiments that I'm going to tell you about soon, where I won't tell you about that aspect, but we showed that this conflict actually reduces the fitness of the species, not the other way around.
Even though female, there's more reproduction going on earlier in the sense, more, you said that the actual...
That's right. The
increases,
What you'll see here is that we found no net effect on her fecundity in this particular example, only a reduction in her survival. But it's going to be a trade-off between all these components, and we can show that on balance, they're harmful to the species. Okay, so where was I? I think what I was telling you is that we have one set of experiments that suggest this conflict occurs, But all of you know that you can get the right result for the wrong reason. We wanted an independent way to corroborate the idea that there's a conflict or an evolutionary cycle going on between the sexes that's driven by evolutionary conflict. So we took advantage of the fact that if there's true genetic monogamy, then the fitness of a male and female is perfectly correlated, and there can't be any conflict, and any segregating variation for conflict would be reverse selected for mutualistic coevolution between the sexes instead of antagonistic coevolution. So in collaboration with one of my students, Brett Holland, we created artificial monogamy by randomly mating the flies and keeping them isolated so they could only mate one male to one female. All the offspring from these crosses were then put into a big pool. We randomly selected 100 new parents and did this generation after generation. The neat thing about this experiment is that everything I saw in the previous experiment should be reversed. If we create artificial monogamy, then the antagonistic coevolution should be reversed to mutualistic coevolution, and the patterns I saw before should be reversed. This is a reminder of the patterns we saw before, and this is what Brett found in the monogamy experiments. Again, no change in the fecundity of the females when continuously housed with the monogamy males compared to the control males that were still promiscuous. Now, the survival of females paired with monogamy males went up relative to controls rather than down, and the seminal fluid became less toxic instead of more toxic. This occurred after only 30 generations. So when we set up experimental conditions where the conflict should go away, antagonistic coevolution was converted into mutualistic coevolution. So these two experiments suggest to us, and there are other experiments from the literature as well, that there is, in fact, an arms race, at least in this species. And what I want to do now is briefly explore some of the consequences of the arms race, and I'm going to specifically focus on the speciation process here. If we have a single species and the arms race is going on, the arms race will drive genetic change within the lineage, but we don't expect it to lead to speciation. But if we introduce allopatry, then the same process will go on independently in the two populations and drive genetic divergence between them. If you consider the kinds of traits that will be involved, there'll be male and female reproductive anatomy, physiology, and behavior. Changes in these traits are likely to produce pre- and post-zygotic reproductive isolation and lead to speciation. And the idea here is that if this goes on for a long enough period of time, there'll be enough changes in the reproductive anatomy, physiology, and behavior between the populations that they can no longer exchange hereditary material, and one species is split into two. Pardon me? In general, it would have to be geographically or temporally, some physical barrier to the exchange of hereditary material between the populations. The general mode is through geography, but it can be done in time as well. So this idea has been tested using the comparative method recently by Goran Armquist's lab. And they took insects, and they divided them into those species that are monogamous and those that are promiscuous. And they looked at the rate of lineage of speciation in the two types of lineages, and they found about a fourfold excess in the speciation rate in the species that were promiscuous compared to those that were monogamous, which is at least consistent with the idea that the arms race drives the specific type of genetic divergence that facilitates the process of speciation. All right, that's it for the old stuff. What I'm going to do now is focus on our newer work on something we call intersexual ontogenetic conflict. This has a very simple foundation. Males and females are different entities, and they represent different environments that genes are expressed within. Males are microgamete machines, sperm machines, and females are megagamete machines, egg machines. And even though this difference in gamete size is small, it selects on a variety of different parts of the phenotype that must evolve to accommodate the fact that they have different tasks. And that means that genes can be selected differently in the two sexes.
Last year, we had at ITP, we had a biologist giving a talk about gamete size. And he talked about this as some kind of spontaneous symmetry. If the male-female gamete size were equal to begin with, they would rapidly become.
Yeah, some species have retained isogamy, so we know that that doesn't always occur. But in most cases, sexes would be expected in simple theoretical models to diverge into large and small gamete types.
With huge ratios, right? In mammals, it's like millions in volume, in weight or something?
Well, it's bigger in many birds than it is in mammals, but yeah, it can be very extreme. Okay, to illustrate the conflict that occurs when we have two different machines, egg machines and sperm machines, I want you to first consider a premier on-the-road machine, like a Ferrari. Now a premier off-the-road machine, like a John Deere tractor. And lastly, a crude mosaic made up half parts from the Ferrari and half from the tractor. I think you'd all agree that this crude mosaic will perform poorly both on the road and off the road. And in the next, whatever I have, the next 40 minutes or so of this seminar, I'm going to go through a series of three experiments that suggest that every morning when you get up and look in the bathroom mirror, this crude mosaic is what you see. And the concept is based on sexually antagonistic alleles. And these are alleles that are favored in one sex, one environment, disfavored in the other sex, the other environment. So in a very general way, we could take the whole phenotype and ordinate it along a single multivariate axis. And because males and females are selected to do different things, they're going to pull that phenotype in different directions because the optimal phenotype for the sexes are different. And we know that most genes in the genome, probably at least 90%, are expressed in both sexes. I want to now express this idea in a more concrete or more explicit population genetic terms. So I want you to consider an arbitrary QTL, or quantitative trait locus, that influences hip size in humans. We know that our ancestors our ancestors had hip sizes that were far more similar on a proportionate basis than they are today. And over evolutionary time, the hip size of females has increased, presumably to accommodate the increased head size of the fetus at the time of birth, that is at parturition.
Similar between the sexes, right, rather than between individuals, and in the ancestors.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, in the ancestors, when you say the hip size is similar, it's similar between males and females?
Yes, so if we look at our ancestors, the hip size are proportionally very similar, whereas today we have far more dimorphism, so they were more monomorphic. It would go back even further than that. So there's been the sexual dimorphism has increased continuously, as has the head size of the fetus at the time of birth.
So Neanderthals would be different from us?
Yeah, Neanderthals, the last Neanderthals only went away about 20,000 years ago, and it's not clear how long they were separate lineage from humans. It's also not clear whether or not we interbred with them. The mitochondrial DNA suggests that we don't, but the nuclear DNA has not been analyzed yet. So where was I? So once you consider an arbitrary QTL that affects hip size, and I've moved back. Hip size is going to be selected differently in the two sexes. In females, it's selected for both parturition, for childbirth, and for locomotion, but in males, it's selected exclusively for locomotion. Now, once you consider a new mutation that has a marked increase in hip size, and it's expressed in both sexes. In females, it could be favored because it facilitates the childbirth process. But if you take something as something as complicated as the hip, and you increase it in size, you're likely to get incidental byproducts that reduce its efficiency. So we expect some reduction in locomotor ability. Nonetheless, if the benefit during parturition more than outweighs the loss in performance and locomotion, this gene could be favored. But the same gene, when expressed in males, the males will express the reduced performance and locomotion, but they don't give birth, so the gene would be sexually antagonistic, favored in females, disfavored in males. Yeah. They could. We'd have to look at the net benefit in males and detriment in females, which I'm about to do, to see if the gene would actually increase. But all I'm saying here is that between the sexes, it's favored in one and disfavored in the other. So you can jump a generation ahead and say, well, it could be favored in daughters, which it would, but it'll still be disfavored in sons and grandsons and great-grandsons. Yeah. I'm assuming that this is a mutation, genetic mutation, causing the effect. So I'm not going to talk about human hip size. I'm just trying to use hip size as something that everybody can relate to as an example of how this process might work. So anyway, we could have genes that are favored in one environment, females, but disfavored in the other. So what I'm going to assume now is that we're at some point in our ancestry where hip size is being selected divergently. The optimal hip size for females is larger than it is for males. And I'm going to model this in the simplest possible way with simple linear fitness functions. So here's the distribution of hip sizes. The male optimum is to the left, the female is to the right, and I'm making the fitness functions linear with the one slope for males. And to make it a little bit more realistic, I'm making the fitness function twice as steep for females compared to males, with the idea that dying during childbirth would be a very strong selective factor on females. So now I'm going to consider the fate of new mutations. At this arbitrary QTL, I'm going to assume that the established allele is A0, that's a reference point, and I'm going to ordinate so it's right at the origin of this Cartesian coordinate system. And we're going to consider the fate of new A1 alleles that influence hip size. And I'm going to characterize the phenotype, or the expression of these genes, by where they plot on this Cartesian coordinate system. One class of A1 mutations we won't be concerned with are those that increase hip size in males and decrease hip size in females. They'll be selected against in both sexes, and they won't accumulate via natural selection. But those that increase hip size in females and decrease hip size in males are favored in both sexes, and they should rapidly accumulate. But these are complex mutations. We know from analyzing many QTLs that they commonly have different effects in the two sexes, but generally in the same direction. To get the same mutation to be expressed in opposite directions in the two sexes will generally require an additional mutation at a modifier locus, or having a gene duplication, whereas one of the duplicated genes is exclusively expressed in females and the other one in males. So these are complex adaptations, which I expect to occur later on rather than early on. Early on, I expect consistent effects with respect to direction, and if they increase hip size, they'll be female benefit sexually antagonistic alleles, and if they decrease hip size, they'll be male benefit sexually antagonistic alleles. So we can do a small amount of arithmetic, and we can solve for the line of mutual equilibria. These are mutations that help one sex just as much as they hurt the other sex. So when averaged across the sexes, they're neutral. We can do this by drawing a line of slope equals 2, and the slope is 2 instead of 1, because the female fitness function is twice as steep as the male fitness function. Any mutation that maps to the right of this line has a net selective advantage, despite the harm to one sex. Any to the left of the line has a net selective disadvantage. So only the mutations to the right will be favored by natural selection. Now, what happens in a finite population depends upon the vagaries of sampling error. Here I've assumed that the first mutation that's introduced by the mutation process and not lost early on by sampling error increases hip size in both sexes, but in females more than males. It maps to the right of the line of neutral equilibria, so it has a net selective advantage, and we expect it to fix. So here's our starting point where we're fixed or accumulated to 100% for the A0 allele. And here's the recruitment of the sexually antagonistic A1 allele. Females move closer to their optimum, males are dragged further from theirs. But we can apply the same logic now once we're fixed for the A1 allele. Draw a line of slope equals 2 through the phenotype of the established A1 allele. Any mutation that maps to the right of this line has a net selective advantage. Here I've assumed that the next mutation introduced by the mutation process, but not lost early on by sampling error, reduces hip size in both sexes, but in males more than in females. It has a net selective advantage, and we expect it to accumulate. So again, here's our starting point with fixed for A0, the recruitment of the first sexually antagonistic allele, and the recruitment of the second sexually antagonistic allele, and the tug of war between the sexes ensues. And this tug of war will continue each time we recruit a new sexually antagonistic allele. So we expect this recruitment process to continue until eventually we get the evolution of modifiers that cause the same gene to be expressed in different directions in the two sexes, or a gene duplication followed by gender-limited gene expression within each sex, and then the tug of war ends. But in the meantime, we generate transient polymorphism Polymorphism occurs when two or more alleles are segregating in the population simultaneously. If the number of loci in the genome that can be selected in this sexually antagonistic way is large, then this transient polymorphism could be substantial at any single point in time. But we can also solve for equilibrium polymorphism. That's where the two alleles are maintained indefinitely in the population. And I'm going to go through two ways, although there are other ways as well, that we could maintain equilibrium polymorphism. The first involves mutations of large effect. I'm going to again assume that we're initially fixed for the A0 allele, and we're going to introduce an A1 allele, which has a large effect on hip size. I'm going to assume it has, for simplicity here, the same effect on hip size on a proportionate basis in both sexes, and it increases hip size. If we introduce the allele, phenotype of the heterozygote. In an outbred population, when mutations are first introduced, they're expressed almost exclusively in the heterozygous state. And in the heterozygous state, because the female fitness function is twice as steep as the male fitness function, females gain in fitness more than males lose, the allele has a net selective advantage. So the gain to females is shown in the red histogram, the loss to males in the blue, the net effect in black. The allele is favored and begins to accumulate. But as it accumulates, it's expressed more and more in the homozygous state. And because of its large effect, we overshoot the optimum for females, and we've generated what's called overdominance or heterozygote advantage, and that'll maintain both alleles in the population indefinitely. Neither allele can exclude the other. The other way, or one other way, to maintain the two alleles is to relax the simplifying assumption of linear fitness functions and make them curvilinear instead. So again, I assume that we're starting with fixation for the A0 allele, and we're going to introduce a small effect allele now that increases hip size in both sexes to the same proportionate degree. Again, in an outbred population, it's expressed almost exclusively in the heterozygous state, that is 1A1 allele and 1A0 allele. And under these conditions, in this part of the parameter space, the female fitness function is steeper than the male fitness function, so the allele helps females more than it hurts males, and it begins to accumulate. But in the homozygous state, now in this range of the parameter space, the male fitness function is steeper than the female function. We've again generated overdominance, or heterozygote advantage, which will maintain the allele indefinitely in the population. So I've tried to show you how we could expect sexually antagonistic fitness variation due to transient polymorphism or equilibrium polymorphism. And the empirical issue is, how common is this stuff, at least in a model system? And not surprisingly, we used flies to look for this type of variation. We've done 5 experiments, and they all suggest that the variation may be remarkably common. And I'm going to walk you through 3 of these experiments. These were done in collaboration with Adam Chippendale on your right, who is a postdoc in my lab that just left and got a real job, and John Gibson, who is a graduate student in my lab who also just finished. This is the logic of these experiments without going through the cytogenetic details. We start with a single sperm, and we use cytogenetic cloning to clone the entire genome, one full set of genes or one genomic haplotype, simultaneously. We amplify this to many copies, package them in sperm, and fertilize a large number of eggs. Using more genetic tools from Drosophila that can only be done with Drosophila, half of these develop into males, half into females, and we measure their performance over their entire lifetime, how well they transmit their genes across one generation, their net fitness, and we've done this for 40 different genomic haplotypes, so we can now have a bivariate plot of the fitness of the same full sets of genes in a male compared to a female. Now, the technique we use here is something we call reverse ecology. Most population geneticists will use molecular or quantitative genetics tools to study species in situ in their natural environment. We've gone to nature and brought in a large outbred population of flies. We maintain it under a fairly rigorous conditions in the lab, and we've let them adapt to the lab for over 250 generations. So now the lab is becoming their native environment, and it has the advantage that we can study them in detail in the lab like we could never do in the field. So to figure out what correlation we'd expect, we've got to take the total genetic variation and decompose it into its parts. We can first decompose it into sexually antagonistic variation versus sexually harmonious. And the major type of variation we expect to be selected in a harmonious fashion are unconditionally mildly deleterious mutations, and we have several lines of evidence that the genome of melanogaster is riddled with these mutations. The more of these unconditionally deleterious mutations there are in the genome, the lower the fitness in both males and females, and it generates a positive correlation. If it's sexually antagonistic and it's gender limited in its expression, it must produce a zero correlation because it's only expressed in one sex. And by definition, if it's gender unlimited in its expression, it'll generate a negative correlation. So we can now make a continuum. We've taken these 40 genomes, expressed them in males and females, and we can solve empirically for the correlation and fitness between the sexes. If we get this result on the left, a strong positive correlation, it would suggest that sexual antagonism is an intellectual curiosity, but it's not important in the evolution of these flies. If at the other extreme we get a negative correlation, it would indicate the variation is very common. And even if we get a zero correlation, we know the zero correlation indicates a lot of sexually antagonistic fitness variation because we already have evidence for a lot of unconditionally deleterious mutations within the genome. We know that this generates a positive correlation, so the zero correlation must be a mixture of the two types. So before I show you the experimental results, I need to walk you through the life cycle of a fly. Like us, they start out as a fertilized egg, but unlike us, they first develop into a feeding larvae. And here the sexes are selected in much the same way, they're feeding machines. And once they secure enough resources, they differentiate into an adult, where males are selected to be microgamete machines and females are selected to be megagamete machines. And we know this selects them differently because of the extensive sexual dimorphism we see in the species. So we first measure fitness across the entire life history and then decompose it into its two sequential components. We expect most of the fitness variation that's antagonistic to be in the adult stage, not the juvenile stage, because in the juvenile stage, the sexes are both selected to do the same thing to secure resources. So we took the 40 genomes and we expressed them in males and females. The data for males and females are virtually identical, so I'll show you data here for females, but the exact same pattern is shown in males. This is a distribution of the 40 genomic haplotypes. The fitness of the best genome is scaled to 1, and lower fitnesses are scaled down proportionately going towards 0. And the important thing here is that there's a lot of phenotypic variation for fitness. Each one of these fitness measures measures the fitness of the genome in 75 different genetic backgrounds, and we take the average. And about 70% of the variation you see here is additive genetic variation, variation that can be communicated between parents and offspring within females. So the bottom line here is that there's an extensive amount of fitness variation in our laboratory population. That just means we have something to study. Well, what contributes to this fitness variation? We can plot total fitness versus juvenile fitness, and despite the extreme scatter you see here, there actually is a significant correlation. About 15% of the fitness variation total is attributable to variation in juvenile performance. But we get a much tighter correlation for adult fitness and total fitness, and about 85% of total fitness is due to differential juvenile performance. So both performance in the adult and juvenile stage contribute to total fitness, but it's dominated by the adult stage. So now I can compare fitness between the sexes. And what I've plotted here is female juvenile fitness, egg to adult survival, versus male adult fitness of the same genomes, egg to adult survival. The line is the line of isometry of equal fitness between the sexes, and there isn't a hint of a deviation from this line of isometry. In general, a genome that makes a good juvenile male makes a good juvenile female, makes a poor juvenile female, makes a poor juvenile male. So the sexes are selected to do the same thing, and we get high concordance in fitness. We see something very different in the adult stage. Up above is the same plot I just showed you for the juvenile stage, and down below is the plot for the adult stage. And the first thing you notice is the extreme scatter compared to the juvenile plot, and that scatter is not statistical noise. 70% of the variation you see on each axis is additive genetic variation within each sex. So the scatter you see is inconsistency in fitness between the sexes. But nonetheless, there's a statistically significant negative correlation, so that on average, a genome that makes a good male makes a poor female, and vice versa. If we combine these two fitness components, the estimated slope is negative, but it's nowhere near statistically significant. So remarkably, we get a zero correlation for Darwinian fitness of the same genomes in a male compared to a female. But you see that there's a lot of scatter here, and that scatter is not noise, it's inconsistency. And we can measure that inconsistency between the sexes by doing an interaction plot. This is the rank fitness of the same genomes in a male compared to a female. Each genome is connected by a line in male compared to a female. And you see a very strong crossing pattern. It's common for genomes to make the best males to make the worst females, and vice versa. So to summarize the data, our laboratory population has a lot of genetic variation for fitness. It also has a lot of molecular variation as well. So it's not an inbred population by any means. This fitness variation is primarily due to differential adult performance, but juvenile performance plays a role as well. We see a positive correlation for juvenile fitness between the sexes, a negative correlation in the adult stage, and these two cancel to give us a net zero correlation. But despite the zero correlation, there's a strong interaction for fitness between the sexes for total fitness, as demonstrated by the strong interaction plot. So if we go back to the original question, are males and females more like the Ferraris and John Deere tractor, without saying which sex is which, or are they more like the crude mosaic? And our data clearly indicates that they're more like the crude mosaic. The adaptive evolution of each sex is compromised by counter-selection in the other sex. The sexes share a common gene pool, that is, they share a common toolkit, but they're selected to do fundamentally different things. So sharing the gene pool is compromising the adaptive evolution of each sex. Now, there's a number of ways to interpret this data, but one of the ones that biologists, at least, are primarily concerned with is the process of sexual selection. If we take a female fly who chooses a male who's the hotshot in sexual selection, we expect her to produce high-fitness sons. They'll share with the sire genes for high reproductive success and genes for high juvenile performance. But the same genes that made the sons have high reproductive performance will cause the daughters to have low performance, so the daughters will at best be mediocre. This means that females have to mate with different males to maximize the fitness of sons compared to daughters. Well, as I told you before, any single experiment can give you the right result for the wrong reason. So we wanted a way to independently corroborate the idea that there's a lot of sexual antagonism in the genome. And we did this by trying to predict where, on a chromosomal basis, most of that negative fitness variation between the sexes should reside. And I'm going to show you why we expect the majority of it to reside on the X chromosome. If we look at the transmission of the X chromosome, 2/3 of the X's reside in females and 1/3 reside in males. In addition, the Y chromosome has almost no functional genes on it compared to its homologue, the X. That means that it can't mask the expression of genes on the X chromosome in males. So consider an arbitrary gene pool, and to make it simple, I've got 10 genes in the gene pool, and one is newly mutated. If it's a rare dominant gene, then its expression in males, because males have a single copy and the Y doesn't interfere with the expression, is its expression in the gene pool, or 10%. But in females, it's nearly double that value. And that's because females have twice as many X chromosomes, so twice as many chances to express the gene. You can think about this by analogy to a lottery. Males have one ticket in the lottery, females have two, so females express the rare trait twice as often. If it's a recessive gene, the pattern is reversed and amplified. Again, males express the gene at its frequency in the gene pool, but females express it at the square of this value, which is much smaller. Using the lottery analogy again, males have one ticket in the lottery, females have two, but to win, to express the trait, females have to win the lottery twice, males only once, so females express it far less frequently. If we look at this difference between the level of expression in males compared to females, it's frequency dependent. So when the gene is rare, the discrepancy is the largest, and as it accumulates, the discrepancy wanes. I won't derive these curves here, but I can solve for the equilibrium frequency of a gene that deviates substantially from codominance for a recessive male benefit allele on the X chromosome or a female benefit dominant gene on the X chromosome. So this is the equilibrium frequency. When it's different from 1 or 0, we have polymorphism. This is the detriment benefit, detriment to one sex, benefit to the other, on a log scale. And what's important is that over almost the entire range, we get polymorphism. So I showed you earlier that we can solve for conditions where the autosomes will give us polymorphism, but it's hard not to get polymorphism on the X chromosome so long as the genes deviate substantially from codominance. So that gives us a very simple and straightforward empirical prediction, and that's that the X should be a hotspot for sexually antagonistic fitness variation. So here's a cartoon of the genome of melanogaster. It has three major chromosomes, two X's and two major autosomes, and the X represents about 20% of the genome. This is the plot of fitness in males and females and adults. We can solve for the correlation between the sexes, and from this we can calculate the negative covariance between the sexes. The whole genome carries all of this negative covariance, and on the null hypothesis that the X codes in proportion to its size, it should carry about 20% of the negative covariance, and on the alternative hypothesis, it should carry more than 20%. So in the previous experiments I told you about, Adam and John cloned the whole genome, or one genomic haplotype. And in the new experiments, John Gibson cloned only the X chromosomes and did the same analysis to ask what proportion of the total variation is on the X. So again, our hypothesis based on the negative correlation is that on the null hypothesis, 20% is on the X, and on the alternative, greater than 20%. Cool thing is, we've got a control. And that control is the positive covariance for juvenile fitness. We didn't have a lick of evidence for antagonism in the juvenile stage, so we can take the positive correlation for fitness in the juvenile stage, calculate the positive covariance, and the null hypothesis and the alternative are that 20% will be on the X, with one caveat. Empirical studies have consistently found the X to be depaupered in molecular variation, so we'd expect it to be depaupered in fitness variation as well. So this is the benchmark for the experiments. What I've shown is 20% of the negative covariance in the adult stage and scaled to the same size, 20% of the positive covariance in the juvenile stage. When John looked at juvenile fitness, he found no measurable fitness variation on the X. Now we know there's some there. This simply indicates that there isn't very much. But on the X chromosome in the adult stage, he found about a five-fold excess. We estimate that 97% of the sexually antagonistic fitness variation resides on the X chromosome. So I want to look at the consequences of having a lot of fitness variation. We estimate that 50% of the fitness variation of the whole genome resides on the X chromosome. This has important implications for sexual selection. Males give their Y to their sons and their X to their daughters. But a big part of what makes a good male good is his X chromosome. So if we again consider females in the context of sexual selection, we expect her to produce, for X-linked fitness traits, mediocre sons, because they get the X from their mother, not from their father. But the same X that made the male a hotshot stud will produce low fitness in daughters because of the negative correlation for fitness for X-linked genes. And this generates negative intersexual heritability. High fitness males tend to produce low fitness daughters. High fitness females tend to produce low fitness sons. So I can do this last one in 3 minutes or I can stop right now. Well, I'm just going to very briefly tell you about the direction of our ongoing experiments. We recently took a set of 119 genomes and we screened them 8 times independently for fitness in males. And from this, we got high-precision measures of fitness. And we took the top 7 that we call Casanova genomes. And these are consistently super studs, no matter what their genetic background. We took 4 from the middle that we call Joe Average genomes, and they're consistently average. And we took them from the bottom that we call Casanova genomes, or Quasimodo genomes. And these consistently are super duds. They just hardly can get females mated. We can take these 18 genomes and then express them in females. As expected, the Joe average males produce Jane average females. In most cases, all but one, the Casanova genomes had a precipitous decline in fitness in females, and three of them had a difference of at least 2 standard deviations. These genomes should be enriched in male benefit, female detriment, sexually antagonistic fitness variation. All of the Casimotos increased fitness in females, and three of them by at least 2 standard deviations, well, at least 1.5 standard deviations. And this should be highly enriched in female benefit, sexually antagonistic alleles. So we tend to use these 6 highly antagonistic genomes to get at the basic phenomenology of sexual antagonism. That is, what kinds of traits mediate the antagonism? It's primarily behavior, anatomy, or reproductive physiology. The QTL analysis will allow us to measure how many genes contribute to the antagonism, and I'm especially interested in a QTL analysis on the X chromosome. And ultimately, we hope to clone and characterize some of these genes to get some estimate of what kinds of genes typically contribute to the antagonism. So this will summarize the second half. This is a model for what we've got so far. If we look at flies at the level of the gonad, or the external genitalia, there's males and females. We virtually never see anything in between. It's about 1 in 10,000 we get an intersex fly. But if we look at the organism at the level of the whole phenotype in the currency of fitness, we see something very different. We see a smooth continuum between the sexes. We think that most males are feminized in the currency of fitness to varying degrees based on a number of female benefit sexually antagonistic alleles that they express. And most males are feminized in varying degrees based on a number of female benefit sexually antagonistic alleles that they express. So the strong dichotomy at the level of the external genitalia is not representative of what you see at the level of the whole organism. So to summarize the whole talk, I tried to tell you about our earlier work where we think that antagonistic coevolution between the sexes rapidly drives genetic divergence between allopatric populations and contributes to speciation. And the last part of the talk is our newer work on ontogenetic conflict, where males and females are fundamentally different environments, and they select genes very differently. That's it.
Thank you for a very clear talk. I'm sure there are questions and comments. Question?
Yeah.
You presented the data for the interlocus conflict evolution after, say, 3 generations.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an idea of what that looked like over the span of the 30, the progress?
No, we didn't look until 30 generations just because we didn't expect to find much. We looked from 30 to 50 generations, so we could see the change after 30. These things don't expect to go fast. And how do I want to say this? So you basically set them up and let them run, and then you wait as long as one NSF grant will allow, and then you assay them. The assays take a lot of work, so it's a lot of work just to maintain the lines. In the monogamy experiments, you have to individually pull out one male and one female, randomly mate them, and do that 100 times. Then you've got to do it for each replicate. Then you've got to do the same thing for the controls, except you have one male with three random, or it's three males with one random female. So the work, the experiments are labor-intensive enough that we don't look until the end. Other experiments where I've looked at speciation, we were able to use the culturing protocol to actually measure what we wanted. We have measures all the way through the experiment. But these, the fitness assays, are things we do a couple of times after enough evolution has gone by that we hope to see a signal.
So the big debate about the rate of evolution, does your current study rely on the rate at which these novelties appear in the population?
Yeah, among population geneticists, nobody thinks there's punctuated evolution. I mean, that's a paleontology thing. There's nothing in the fossil record that would indicate that there's any punctuation at the genetic level. Pardon me? Yeah, his punctuation was in cell size in those experiments. And one gene can rapidly produce a major change in cell size. You can't extrapolate those experiments to metazoans. And you may have probably saw Jerry Coyne's and Brian Charlesworth's rebuttal to those experiments as well. I think that they're very clever experiments, but they don't tell us that we change the way the fossil record would suggest we change. The fossil record, there's some recent work being done right now on wood rats. And they have the genetic data as well, because they can. These are less than 10,000 years old, and they can still PCR amplify the DNA. And they get some punctuated changes, and they can prove that it's due to invasion into the area, not a rapid change in the existing population. That kind of data has never been available for the paleontological data. They don't know if the rapid change is an invasion or a rapid change in the in situ population. Humans. Unfortunately, the mouse people haven't done the critical experiments. The invertebrate biologists have found the same pattern in a variety of different invertebrates. I suspect that there's a seminal fluid effect of males on females. I expect it to be small because females would be co-evolving with males. At any single point in time, males might have an advantage, or another time, females might have the advantage. We know in some flies, females have totally co-opted this system. They've evolved to digest seminal fluid proteins, and they use them as food. They basically feed their babies all these seminal fluid proteins the males are trying to use to manipulate their phenotype. So you're going to get these flip-flops where one sex or the other may have an advantage, but most of the time, you expect parity. And there's a paper that's going to come out tomorrow from Goran Arnquist's lab that shows the same sort of thing in, what are those things? Water striders.
Some of these will marry and have children. Mm-hmm. Now, the dominant male would produce dominant, you know, superstar's son. But the dominant female would decrease the superstar's son. Do they have any mediocre children?
Well, I don't know how much of this is going to be an athletic performance. We measure fitness rather than athletic performance, so I don't know what the transition between athletic performance and fitness will be. But I do think that first off, the male may not produce super sons because of his X chromosome effect. That's about 5% of our genome, but we don't know how much fitness variation is on there. The Drosophila data suggests that the X chromosome carries far more than 5% of the fitness variation. We don't know in humans right now. But the idea, though, is that, if you're trying to produce a particular type of athlete, you might not look for the same characteristics in the male and female because they may not map out that way for fitness. For athletic ability, though, they may. I don't know.
Actually, it's best to make theoretical physicists to athletes.
A question about the kinds of experiments you can do.
Yes.
It doesn't sound like you have done this, but are you able to do something that has been done in the case of bacteria? Actually, I think you looked at where you actually compare different generations. I mean, can you basically store a generation
No.
and then go back and have it breed with another one?
At this point, we can't. So there are techniques for freezing embryos and then reviving them. And a couple of labs have reported that they've been able to do this. They had one technician that could do it. That technician quit, and nobody can duplicate the results. So it looks like something we're going to be able to do, because I think these are real results. I don't think that they were inaccurate in their report. But it turns out to be a very touchy thing, and the stock centers would love to be able to do this.
It could be very interesting for the first part of your phone. Basically access the time information.
Right. What we do, though, we can compare them back to the ancestors. One thing I didn't tell you is we took the monogamy females. We mated them to the monogamy males and the ancestor males, which were under the same conditions for the same period of time.
Going back to 30 generations.
Yeah. So they were evolving at the same time. So they've evolved in parallel, but... we don't think these traits are evolving that quickly in populations that aren't artificially made monogamous or artificially just have one sex that can evolve. And we found that those females were harmed more by the ancestral males than they were by the monogamy males. And they were hurt more by the ancestral males than were the promiscuous females. And it suggests that the adaptation that females have to resist male harm are useful in other contexts. When the males evolve to become nicer, then the females sort of let down their defense because they can now maximize fitness in other components besides resisting harm by males. But we can't do the same trick right now. We can't freeze flies.
Yesterday you were telling me that in some cases the X chromosome would try to kill the Y chromosome.
Well, that's a process called meiotic drive. Intragenomic conflict predicts that chromosomes will sometimes have battles with one another, and we know that they do. Suppose there were, let's make it simple, suppose there were a Y chromosome, that when sperm were formed, one cell that has an X and Y produces four cells, two with Y chromosomes, two with X's. If the Y chromosome had two genes on it, one for a long-lasting toxin and one for a short-lived antitoxin, then when they're one cell, it's okay because the Y is producing the toxin and antitoxin. But when the cells then divide into two Y-bearing sperm and two X-bearing sperm, if the antitoxin is short-lived, then the X1s die. And we know that just that mechanism occurs in a variety of ways in a variety of animals. So we don't expect units of the genome to evolve harmoniously. The same thing occurs between nuclear genes and cytoplasmic genes, like I talked about here. The cytoplasmic genes will kill off sons to promote the fitness of daughters, even though that's bad for nuclear genes. So the idea that the genome is evolving harmoniously is under siege right now. We have lots of evidence for conflict driving a lot of the evolution we see.
Question from the back. I was just wondering, is there any way to extrapolate this to whether it would be more advantageous or disadvantageous to have a third sex or more than two sexes?
Yeah, there are some bacteria, there are some microorganisms that have multiple sexes. They aren't as differentiated as males and females are. They just have different compatibilities with other genotypes. Most of the theory suggests that you'll always converge on two sexes, a megagamete sex and a microgamete sex. How robust that theory is to its simplifying assumptions, I'm not sure. But at least the simplified theory says it's always going to go to two, except when you have... when you never make gametes at all, such as some protozoans, which have multiple sexes. They aren't truly sexes, though. They're mating types.
Further questions? Yes?
No. Should not be surprised that 40 generations in busy numbers.
No, there's so much fitness variation in the genome that's maintained either by mutation selection balance. So each individual locus may have very little variation, but when summed across 30 or 50,000 loci, it's a lot of variation. Most of the experiments that I've told you about probably started with existing variation rather than waiting for new mutations to occur. And it's because of the large genome size and the fact that there are so many loci you could potentially select on that we have ample genetic variation. What we do is we'll take a vial and we'll put in a prescribed number of target eggs that carry the target genome, and usually in a 2-to-1 ratio we'll put in competitors. And then we'll let those eggs develop and they feed in the food and compete with one another. Then they come out and then the females compete for a limiting amount of yeast which they need to yolk up to make eggs, so there's scramble competition for that yeast, and males compete for competition with those. So we measure how well the males did in that by doing paternity analysis on a large number of females to figure out who they mated with. And females, we just measure how many eggs they produce after they've competed for this limiting resource. The various flies are marked in ways that we can tell who's who, the competitor versus the target.
Question?